This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Robert Morley, contributing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and today's host for Trumpet Hour. Joel Hilliker is out of town, but he will be back next week. Thank you for listening in. We have what I think is just a fantastic program for you today. I'd like to start by introducing our panel. These gentlemen make up the editorial and news bureau staff of the Philadelphia Trumpet Magazine and the Trumpet.com website. And gentlemen, as I introduce you, if you wouldn't mind just giving us a bit of a brief description of the news item that you brought for us today, that would be great. I have here in the studio with me Jeremiah Jacques. Jeremiah tends to cover issues related to Asia. Welcome, Jeremiah.
Hello there. Yeah, today I'll be talking about the people of Russia. They've weighed in on the United States presidential election, and they're strongly in favor of the idea of America being led by someone different than almost the rest of the world wants. We'll reveal the answer when we get there.
We also have Brent Noctegal, who follows the Middle East region. Big welcome to you, Brent.
Hello, good to be here. I'll be talking a little bit later on a leaked document that undermines the traditional backing that Syrian strongman Bashar al-Assad has received for a long time, and we'll just explore what might happen if he loses that support.
Okay, that sounds great. I'd also like to welcome Richard Palmer. He's also today based out of Edstone, England, or actually he's always based out of Edstone, England, but Brent is over there with him today. Richard, what do you have for us today?
Yeah, good afternoon. Great to be here. What will Europe look like if Britain votes to leave in the upcoming referendum? Some have been saying that it would be a disaster and all fall apart, but another authority says it could lead to a powerful Europe with a renewed focus on its military and dominated by Germany.
Okay, excellent. I'm looking forward to that. Last but not least, here in the studio, we have Andrew Miller. Thank you very much for joining us today, Andrew.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show. Today we'll be talking about Islamic terrorists on America's southern border and attempts to legalize drugs on America's northern border.
Today we'll begin with a top story, and this top story has to do with Germany and Turkey. And for this one, I'd like to bring in Richard for his comments. But before I do, as you may know, Europe is currently just being swamped with migrants from the Middle East. And last year, more than a million migrants, mostly from Syria and Iraq and Libya, made the perilous journey into Europe. The BBC reported that this year alone, there's probably been upwards of another 200,000 or so who have made it into Europe. And a good chunk of these migrants are heading for Germany. And they're doing that because they want to take advantage of Germany's generous welfare system. And so far, Angela Merkel, she's been very welcoming. She's just opened up her arms to the migrants. But now it appears that even Merkel may be beginning to crack, maybe perhaps having some second thoughts about this open door policy. And Europe appears to be starting to wake up to the fact that it needs to do something about this. And this week, Germany did something, or at least a report from Der Spiegel magazine is saying that Germany is about to do something, and it could be pretty big. So Richard, could you tell us a little bit about what's going on with Germany and Turkey?
Yeah, Germany is going to be opening up a new military base, or rather building an extension onto a Turkish base to house its military. It's spending 65 million euros, so I guess that's somewhere probably around 75 million US dollars to build a base over there. It will be built at the Incirlik Air Base. That's where the German army is currently flying reconnaissance missions and refueling missions into Syria. But it's going to include an air control center for German aircraft. There'll be accommodation for soldiers. There'll be a combat headquarters. And then Germany is, according to these reports, in discussion with Turkey about a treaty for stationing German soldiers on Turkish soil for long-term deployments. So we're looking at a dramatic expansion of German military presence in Turkey, in the region. And it's not just an overnight thing. They're looking at a much more permanent establishment within Turkey as well. So this is quite a big deal. And they appear to be in quite a bit of a hurry for this. They want to be complete it to be complete by 2017. Now, as far as what we know about this, it all comes from a leaked report to Spiegel magazine. So it's not official yet. Spiegel is a pretty reliable source, though. But what we can tell based on the leaks is that they're going to start moving forward with this very fast, that they've already been kind of feeling, sending out feelers for getting with contractors and things like that in the region. So a significant move, and could be quite a quick move as well.
So what did this leaked report, what are the analysts saying is the motivation behind this new base in Turkey?
Well, I don't know if the leaked report discusses the motivation at all, but a lot of it is connected with Germany's military mission in Syria, which began after the Paris attacks. So I think most of our listeners will be aware. You had the bombing in Paris, and then we made quite a big deal of the fact that Turkey turned to the European Union and not to NATO for help. They invoked the European Union self-defense clause for the first time ever. And Germany's response to that, I think some were disappointed, but if you look at it in context of Germany's history, it was dramatically faster than Germany's response to any other call for help following a terrorist attack. It was quite large when you include all of the people in the naval mission, in the aerial mission, in the reconnaissance parts of the flight. I think it totaled around 500 people. And so this is, then should support that mission and allow them to ramp up their involvement in Syria and really have a much more robust presence in what is the world's biggest hotspot right now.
A lot of people have, Richard, criticized Ms. Merkel for her relationship with Turkey's Prime Minister Erdogan there. Mm-hmm. And but as you said, this really is a hotspot over there. So just looking forward, is this kind of relationship that we see here between Merkel and Erdogan, is this something that we can expect to see more of in the future, this deepening of relationship between Germany and Turkey?
Absolutely. We don't know how the ebbs and the flows are going to go, what any immediate backlash might be against Erdogan's authoritarian policy, but we do have the guide of Bible prophecy, and that very clearly and strongly puts Turkey in an alliance with Arabic nations that allies itself with Europe and may even ally itself with Europe in quite a special way. Now, we know that Turkey is not going to be part of the European Union. The European Union, as even some of its own officials have said, is a Christian club, and they're not about to invite this Muslim country in. But the Bible tells us that there will be a strong relationship and alliance between Europe and Turkey. As I said, there may be some ups and downs as we get towards that, but that is the eventual destination.
Yeah, and this has been a relationship that's even played out historically, hasn't it? I mean, there are some parallels to World War I even in that relationship between those two nations.
Right, and even prior to World War I, you had the Armenian genocide, and you had Turkey was doing a lot of terrible things. A lot of other European nations were turning their backs on Turkey. And Kaiser Wilhelm saw this as a wonderful opportunity to really develop Germany's relationship with Turkey, to draw much closer and to build Turkey into a stable ally. Even before that, you had a French relationship with the Ottoman Empire. So there's a long history of European powers using Turkey and to project power into the Middle East, to help them gain power in the Mediterranean. And then going on into World War II with Kaiser Wilhelm, he ultimately tried to kind of stir up a jihad and a almost religious war against Britain and against the West in the Middle East. And Turkey was a linchpin for that effort. And it was kind of his core in liaising with the Islamic world. So there's a lot of history there.
Yeah, Richard. And one of the things that stands out to me is just how this fits in prophetically with what the Bible says is going to happen. I think you alluded to that relationship between Turkey and Germany that's talked about in Psalm 83. But there's also another prophecy that we've written a lot about at the Trumpet that Gerald Fleury has pointed to. Readers can go to our website and they can Google the whirlwind prophecy. And that really is talking about this prophecy that's contained in Daniel 11. And it does seem significant to me that Germany is placing troops here in Turkey.
Right. Actually, I have a couple of quotes right in front of me from that article where Mr. Flory writes, here is the question we need to focus on. How could Germany do this, or confront Iran so easily, so effectively, and so quickly? Berlin will not be able to overwhelm Iran in the near future unless it's working on a special strategy right now. And this Turkish airbase idea, it came out of the blue. I think it surprised a lot of people because there wasn't a whole lot of talk about doing anything like this. And then a bit further down, Mr. Flory, he goes on to talk about how the emphasis in the verse in Daniel 11 that talks about the whirlwind is on the strategy of the military attack. It talks about it being a whirlwind, and he says it whirls around you. It whirls you away. Look at a map, and you can see Germany's strategy to surround Iran and its allies. And this ties right into that. Germany has a major presence in Afghanistan, and even as other nations like Britain have drawn away from Afghanistan, and retreated from there, Germany has remained steadfast and has become, I believe, they're about the second biggest player there. They're developing a major presence in Mali. They've consistently had a major military presence in the eastern Mediterranean, off Cyprus. And now they're building up an airbase in Turkey. So it ties in perfectly with that whirlwind strategy.
Well, thank you very much for that, Richard. For those of you who would like more information on the whirlwind prophecy, go ahead and log on to thetrumpet.com and search that phrase, the whirlwind prophecy. You'll see a Kia David television program come up on that. You'll see some articles on that just to give you more insight in what that's talking about. But you're absolutely right, Richard. When you look at what Germany is doing and as it moves south and east, you really do have to put that in context of its prophesied confrontation of radical Islam and radical Islam led by Iran. So thank you very much for that report, Richard. This is the Trumpet Hour radio show on 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma. You might be listening to kpcg.fm online. We have been talking with trumpet writer Richard Palmer about Germany's new Air Force base in Turkey. The days of Germany being reluctant to use its military really have ended, and I think we are seeing a rise of German militarism again. Only this time, unlike what happened in World War II, this time we're seeing America and the West really encouraging it. We're seeing America encouraging Germany to remilitarize, to spend more on its military, to take on a bigger role internationally. And this is even something that we're seeing play out in politics in America today. Donald Trump, the Republican frontrunner, President Obama, both have, whether it's Democrats or Republicans, both have been encouraging Germany to step up and spend more and start interacting with the world more. And this really is a short-sighted strategy. History, anybody who understands history should know that, but even more so prophecy. The Bible says that this is going to end in disaster. So for more of that, feel free to log on to thetrumpet.com, and there's plenty of articles talking about that there and what the Bible says about that. But since we're on the subject of Syria, I'd like now to talk a little bit about President Bashar Assad. This is the man that many analysts say is responsible for the deaths of more than a quarter of a million people. I think that's the United Nations estimate. Other groups put it much closer to half a million people. And we've been looking at this man and how he's been just clinging to power and wondering, you know, how numbered are his days? But he refuses to give up. But now there appears to be cracks starting to form in his power structure there. It seems like he might be slipping a little bit. And Brent, I know that you're following this situation very closely right now over in Syria. What's going on over there now?
Well, what we'll talk about to start off with is just another leak that has come out in the past month. And there was just another article about it this week. And it describes the relationship that Assad has with the Alawite base. They are I think they make up about 15%, I believe, of Syria. The people, they're a offshoot of Shia Islam, although they're claiming in this document. It's a document that was written by different sheikhs, different leaders of the Alawite community. And they're trying to give a distinction to the world between the Alawite people and what they believe and what they want for Syria and the actions of Assad over the past 5 years while the Syrian civil war has raged. So it's really interesting, the timing of this as well. It seems since Russia intervened in Syria coming last October, that Assad's rule was kind of stabilized. It looked for a while that he was going to be thrust out of power, that even his regime would fall, but then Russia came and rescued him, or at least the Syrian regime. And the people that were always on his side, it seemed, were the Alawites, he himself being an Alawite belonging to this religious sect. So we didn't really expect, or the world hasn't really expected, commentators haven't expected, that there was going to be a falling out between him and his main supporters.
I think that's very interesting. It seems like when you start losing the support of your own people, then it becomes progressively, exponentially harder to hang on to power. I think a lot of people have looked to Russia and said Russia has really supported Assad, and as long as Russia's there, Assad will be able to hang on. What do you think about that?
I think that that for Russia, it's not that important that Assad is there. He is just one man, and he has allowed the relationship with Russia to continue. He's ensured that Russia's naval base could stay there and occupy a region on the western or eastern Mediterranean. So he's ensured that Russia's presence could stay there in the Mediterranean region. But that can continue if the next group of leaders or the next leader of Syria honors those agreements with Russia. So Assad isn't essential for Russia. Russia cares that the Syrian regime, the Syrian, probably the Alawites, I'm not sure, but they are concerned mostly that the people that rule Syria will not boot out Russian forces, will have maintained close ties with Russia, would ensure that Syria answers to Russia. What we've seen with Assad over the past decade was, unlike his father, who was closer to the Russians, Bashar al-Assad has gotten much closer to Iran. Assad's regime has been funded heavily by the Iranians, and it's more of a personality that the Iranians are attached to. They're attached to the personality of al-Assad, but the Russians are attached to the institutions of the Assad regime, the political structure that exists in Syria that allows Russia to have a presence there. So it is interesting. While we even have said that at the beginning that Russia is there, or Putin is in there to stabilize Assad, while that may be true for the short term, I don't think that he is essential for Russia's long game strategy there. So I think we could even see that Russia does support some type of political transition, and they've even said as much, away from Assad. As long as they can continue their presence there, they could let Assad go pretty easy.
So Assad leaves. If Assad goes, is this a plus or minus for Iran and Iran's interests in Syria?
Yeah, of course, this isn't a plus for Iran's interest if Assad goes. It could definitely be somewhere where you see Russia, United States, Europe coming together, and with this peaceful, it's probably not going to be a peaceful transition, but you can see them coming up with a UN-backed interim government that doesn't totally destroy the Alawites from ruling, and they would be all for that, and Russia would look like the good guy in this. And the only real actor to lose out in power terms inside Syria would be Iran.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that report, Brent. Looks like we're getting ready for some changes in Syria. We should expect changes coming in Syria, a long-term repositioning of Syria. We'll be watching developments. We know that you'll be watching them too. Prophecy is moving along in Syria. Next up, let's talk a little bit about the Islamic State and Hezbollah. And for that, I'd like to turn to one of the analysts here in Edmond, because the Islamic State and Hezbollah are now being found with greater presence in areas very close to America. Andrew.
This is really, I think, one of the biggest underreported stories in America. You hear about it sometimes, but it does not get a lot of news coverage here. But they had actually another leak this week by Judicial Watch, which is like a legal watchdog agency based out of Washington, D.C., that there's actually an ISIS leader figurative stone's throw away from the southern border in Mexico. Sheikh Mahmoud Omar Kabir He's from Kuwait. He's trained hundreds of Al-Qaeda fighters in the Middle East, but for the past year or so, he's relocated to just close to Tijuana, Mexico. And Judicial Watches bring out that he's actually training fighters down there, and recently bragged to an Italian newspaper, didn't have an English translation, so it didn't get a ton of publicity, but if he wanted to, he said he could get a handful of men and kill thousands of people in Texas or Arizona in the space of a few hours.
Ever since September 11th, America, we had this big outpouring of concern. People realized we needed to do more to protect the nation. Now, suddenly it seems a decade and a half later, it's like we almost don't give the idea that there could be another major terrorist attack on U.S. soil much play. It's like we don't even hear about it in the news. And yet at the same time, we have terrorists, known terrorists discovered south of the border working with the drug cartels. I mean, this seems like this is something that we should be taking a lot more seriously.
Right. And the State Department and the Department of Homeland Security have reported in the past. I mean, in the past, they focused more on Hezbollah than ISIS, since they're more of a new thing.
Now, Hezbollah is basically the terrorist group that works out of Lebanon, right? They're also an Iranian proxy.
Yeah, they're based out of Lebanon, but they're an arm of the Iranian government.
So we have Hezbollah, an arm of the Iranian government, operating with the cartels south of the border, and we have Islamic State operating south of the border.
Yeah, just getting to her both of them now, and I've got even from several years ago, I think 2003, there was a Homeland Security official who was really bringing out that he said that Hezbollah, you actually almost be more concerned on them. They don't seem as scary as ISIS sometime, but they're have a much more centralized command structure. He had said that Hezbollah is really almost like the A team of terrorism, as opposed to Al-Qaeda or ISIS, which are more like the B team, because even though they do have a centralized command within the Middle East, once you get into Europe and South America, they operate in some ways more like a franchise. You get in South America, I mean, you do have cells that, I mean, this man in Mexico, he's obviously got a sizable group working for him, but he has some autonomy that, and then if he conducts an attack, he can slap ISIS on it like a brand name. It's not necessarily a whole global organization run from taking orders from the Ayatollah of Iran.
Right. Now Hezbollah, this is an organization that has attacked American interests in the past.
Right. And they've
So it's not like they haven't. There's no precedent for them attacking and killing Americans,
in 1994 they attacked the Israeli embassy in Buenos Aires, Argentina. So they've done terrorist attacks there before. I mean, I think the reports coming from the State Department now are saying these days they're not focusing so much on attacks because they're providing logistic support in the drug cartels in return for money that they can use to fund terrorism in the Middle East.
Okay. If you ask Donald Trump, I'm sure he'd probably say a wall would take care of this. What do you think? will a wall solve this problem?
Well, they're getting better and better with submarines and tunnels, so I think they can easily get around a wall if they want to.
Okay, walls don't work so well for submarines. Thank you for that report, Andrew. We'll be watching that southern border. For those of you who are just joining us, you're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review on KPCG.fm or 101.3 on the FM dial. We've been talking about why Germany is building a new Air Force base in Turkey. We've talked about why Syrian President Bashar Assad's days in power may be nearing an end, and new evidence showing that Islamic State and Hezbollah are operating in Mexico and Latin America, right on our southern border. Now, all these articles that we've been discussing today, they're in this week's edition of the Trumpet Weekly. It's really a very informative, high-quality report that we produce each week. It contains the most significant stories, the very best commentary that we can find from the best sources. So I'd like to encourage you to subscribe to this free weekly news report. Just go to thetrumpet.com and click on the subscribe tab and become a subscriber. Okay, we have a break coming up, but before we get to that break, I'd like to talk with Jeremiah Jacques. This past week, we saw Donald Trump deliver a clean sweep through Maryland, Delaware, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, and Rhode Island. So he swept through there, collected almost all of the delegates. But there's this new poll out concerning Donald Trump. Tell us a little bit about this poll.
Yeah, the people of Russia have weighed in on the U.S. elections, and they are strongly in favor of Trump becoming the next president. That was the conclusion of a survey that was conducted by YouGov. It was published on April 18th, and it showed that among Russian citizens, Trump is more than 20 percentage points ahead of the next closest candidate, which is Hillary Clinton. And it's interesting to me for a few different reasons. First of all, this poll was not just conducted among Russians. It actually surveyed all of the G20 countries besides the United States. And the G20 countries are the world's most powerful economies for the most part. And the poll showed that in all the other countries, the people were strongly in favor of Clinton over Trump. In Mexico, for example, Clinton had a 54-point lead over Trump. That's no surprise, really, given the statements Trump has made about the really contentious immigration issue and his promises to make Mexico build a wall there along the border. And then in Italy, Clinton had a 38 percentage point lead over Trump. In South Korea, 37%. In Germany, 36%. It was the same story for almost all of these nations. Actually, for all of them, except for Russia. They're all strongly in favor of Clinton, but then you get to Russia and it's just the opposite. So he's leading there with about a 21 percentage point lead. And we've talked before about how Russian President Vladimir Putin has spoken out really favorably on Donald Trump. He's called him a talented and colorful individual, I think. And now we see his people doing the same thing. And I think it says a lot about the Russian mindset, their appreciation of forceful leadership. But we've also heard Trump talk a good bit about wanting the United States not to be so deeply involved in affairs abroad and becoming more isolationist in a lot of ways. He's even said that when the U.S. intervened in Iraq and Libya, that it just turned it all into a big mess. And all of those ideas are totally in line with Putin's worldview and with that of most of Russians. They view America's interventionist policies as meddling and as just causing more problems than they solve. And they would really welcome a United States that wants to just focus on itself and let some other nation, like, oh, I don't know, Russia, for example, become the new global policeman. And then it's also interesting that Trump's nature, which seems to be very non-ideological and very much focused on making deals, that's what he's always talking about, let's make a deal, that is very much in line with the current Russian model, the oligarchs and whatnot. It's a mindset that might make Trump an ideal partner for someone like Putin. So I believe that if Trump wins, it would almost certainly mean the end of the sanctions on Russia and the end of the attempts at isolating Russia by the West. Those things are bad for business. And Trump, first and foremost, seems to be a businessman, an entirely practical negotiator and deal maker. So I wonder, what would the world look like with two machismo-fueled men, two men who really seem to place the lion's share of their faith in themselves at the helm? What would that world look like? And it's hard to say. I don't think it would look great. But maybe we'll see firsthand by this time next year.
Well, Trump, Russians love Trump. The rest of the world hates Trump. Russians hate Hillary Clinton. The rest of the world loves Hillary Clinton. I'm having a little bit of difficulty trying to figure out if this is a good thing or a bad thing. Pretty much the whole world loved President Obama before he was elected, and what a mess these last 7 years have been. But at the same time, I suppose, a lot of the world disliked President Bush, too, and things weren't a whole lot better under him, especially towards the end of his term in office. So, all right, Jeremiah, thank you very much for that very, very interesting report. Coming up next, we'll discuss the looming battle in Mosul, that's in Iraq. We will also talk about the future of the European Union without Britain. Also, Canada's push to legalize marijuana. And then finally, a story about Thailand. I don't think we've discussed Thailand before, so that's a first. That's coming up. You are listening to 101.3 on the FM dial or kpcg.fm online. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Welcome back. This is Trumpet Hour with your host, Robert Morley, filling in for Joel Hilliker. You're listening to the Week in Review program, looking at the big stories from around the world this past week. In the last segment, we were talking about a new poll about Donald Trump's popularity and how he is about the most popular, well looked upon potential president of the United States in Russia. The Russians love him, yet the rest of the world really hates him. And they don't think he'd be a great president at all. Over the break, we were discussing this, and Richard, I thought, had an interesting comment. So I'll just go ahead and ask Richard, go ahead and tell us your thoughts on this poll.
Well, just over the last week or so, Donald Trump has hired a man called Paul Manafort as his campaign chief. Now, one of Paul Manafort's most notable previous clients was Viktor Yanukovych. He was the president of Ukraine, who was essentially a U.S. enemy and a Putin ally. He was basically one of Vladimir Putin's puppets. And Trump's new campaign chief helped prop him up, helped support him. And he was, you know, he was a despot. He looked like he fired on his own people, rigged elections, etc. And it's hard to imagine another U.S. political candidate hiring someone who used to work for him. And, you know, what does that say about the potential relationship and potential closeness that President Trump would have with Vladimir Putin? I mean, could we see a complete reversal in U.S. policy when it comes to Russia and comes to Ukraine? And I think the appointment raises a lot of very interesting questions.
Yeah, it is very interesting because most people would probably look at Republicans and say, okay, Republicans, war hawks, they're the ones that would want to keep the war going with Russia. But here we have, as you said, a man very closely associated with Putin and Putin's ideology working for Donald Trump. Andrew.
Yeah, Donald Trump gave his big foreign policy campaign speech yesterday, and he keep talking about how we have to put America's needs first and keep using that phrase, America first, as well. And I mean, maybe it was just the best way he thought to describe his point, but it was kind of an unfortunate use of terms that there have been quite a bit of media coverage on in the last 24 hours, is that America First was a political organization in 1940, which was most famous for its isolationist foreign policy and saying that we shouldn't get involved in World War II, we shouldn't oppose Hitler, we shouldn't even put economic sanctions on Hitler, we should just stay here and mind our own business, which is similar to some of Trump's foreign policy standpoints that I could see going over very well with someone like Vladimir Putin.
Yep. Either way, we have some very interesting presidential candidates. This next year is going to be, well, interesting. Let's go ahead and move on. Let's turn back to Iraq. We've been talking in the first half a little bit about Syria, some of the players involved there. We've talked about Turkey. But in Iraq, there's some big news and some potential news for potential new entrant into the war in Iraq. Brent, tell us what's going on.
The Defense Secretary of the United States, Ashton Carter, he said just this Wednesday that the U.S.-led coalition in Iraq will be ready to begin the long-awaited assault on the Islamic State's base in Mosul in June. Now, this is something – Mosul is like the second or third largest city in Iraq. And it was overtaken by ISIS back in June 2014. And this is inside Iraq, it's probably the last huge city that the Islamic State belonged to, or long the Islamic State dominate and pretty much control. Now, there's been discussions for the past year on when and if and who is going to make up the forces that try and take this city. When the Islamic State took it over, there was 2.5 million people inside Mosul. So this place is huge. It's right in the northern part of Iraq, bordering on a region that has got a lot of different sects. You've got the Kurds to the east and the north. It's mainly a Sunni city. Shiites are nowhere really to be found in that territory. And yet when the Islamic State took it over, a Sunni organization, basically, people started to wonder, how are we going to get this back from the Islamic State and not cause a greater problem once the Islamic State is removed? Now, there are a bunch of forces that are mobilizing for this battle to try and take back this city. And the one that we're reporting on in the Trumpet Weekly this week is that Iran, who has an interest in Iraq that we've talked about for a decade or so, they a saying that they're mobilizing Hamas, the Gaza Strip terrorist organization, to come and join that fight. Now, I don't know whether they will be able to successfully mobilize Hamas, since they're so far away and that they already have a lot of supporters or Shiite-based Shiite supporters on the ground in Iraq already, that they can throw their weight behind. So I don't know if they're going to do that, but it does show that world powers are looking at Mosul and they are beginning to try and come up with a strategy to successfully take this city from the Islamic State.
It is very interesting. One point we've made in the Philadelphia Trumpet magazine before is, and we've made on this program before, is how ISIS or Islamic State, its presence has really benefited Iran. If Mosul falls, do you see this as, you know, is this potentially the end of ISIS as a major threat in that region? And what does that mean for Iran and American foreign policy, et cetera?
Yeah, I can see this once it happens, and once they do remove Islamic State from Mosul, this probably being the beginning of the end for Islamic State inside Iraq. But the moment that happens, you're going to have a disaster on your hands. We know that Islamic State, when they leave cities, they lay mines everywhere. So that's going to be the whole city is going to be booby trapped for one. But then you have to decide who's going to take over the city, who's going to take control of it once they leave. As I said, it's mainly a Sunni population, and yet the people fighting to remove Islamic State from this city aren't Sunnis mainly. You have the Kurds that are coming from the east and the north. They wouldn't mind nibbling on a bit of Mosul in the future and maybe taking it as part of their autonomous state in the future. That's maybe why they want to bring their money and their soldiers to die in fighting against Islamic State in Mosul. But then you also have the Iraqi army, which are mostly made up of Shiites. And then you have the Shiite militias that are backed by Iran as well, that will be included in this fight. So you talk to from the reports that are coming out of Mosul is that the Sunnis that are there are just as worried as those that take over the city than they are of the Islamic State. There have been widespread reports of what happens to these Shiite militias once they take back Sunni-dominated cities from the Islamic State. They get in there and they say that a lot of you Sunnis, you let Islamic State take over. You are a Sunni. You are a I forget what the word is that they call an infidel, but you're close to being an infidel. And since you allow them to take over, they rule with a strong fist and they commit as atrocious acts on these Sunni residents as Islamic State does as well. So who's going to take control? I have a quote here from Michael Rubin from Commentary Magazine. He wrote this week, "Make no mistake, it will be a great day when ISIS is on the defensive inside Mosul, but it will be the end of the beginning rather than the beginning of the end." And what we expect at the Trumpet is that these Shiite militias that have no business really ruling over a Sunni population, they are using this as a reason to project power north from Baghdad, which they control, and gobble up more territory of Iraq. And this is what the population inside Mosul fears. I don't think that they're going to be willing to kill Well, have their soldiers on the front lines, these Shiite militias, be killed unless they're going to get something from it in the end. And it looks like they're wanting to creep northward with their Shiite dominance over Iraq.
To me, this just brings out a couple of things. One, those Shiite militias, as you mentioned, they really owe their allegiance to Iran in many ways. I mean,
Mostly so, definitely, yep.
Okay, so here we're seeing another piece of evidence of Iran projecting, being able to increase its influence in Iraq. The other thing that might be interesting is, where does ISIS go when it's driven out of Mosul? Does it head west into Syria? What happens with that?
I believe that would be the case. Raqqa inside Syria is basically due west from Mosul, so they'll probably head into Syria. But what they're trying to do is circle this city of Mosul so that none of them escape. But then again, what happens if you just look back at the cities that have fallen back into Iraqi hands after the defeat of Islamic State from them, the Islamic State fighters, there were 20,000 when they started to be surrounded, and then they only kill 5,000, 5,000 gets away, and the other 10,000 sink back into the population, of which they probably came from initially. So this... you will lose Islamic State from this area once Mosul is taken over, but there's still going to be a lot of fighting inside the city.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that report, Brent. Let's go ahead and change directions a little bit here. For those of you who are just turning in, we've been discussing the Middle East, Germany building an Air Force base in Turkey, Bashar Assad losing power, terrorist organizations working with Mexican cartels. Now let's talk a little bit about Britain. There's a big referendum coming up in Britain in June, and the nation will vote on whether or not it will stay in the EU. And from what I understand, Richard, you can tell us more about this if you'd like. The polls are pretty close. But analysts are now starting to wonder what Europe will look like without Britain. Richard Palmer, I know you're on top of this story. Tell us a little bit about what's going on.
Well, there have been quite a few people who have been saying if Britain leaves the EU, then the National Front and a whole load of these other Europe skeptic parties, the PVV in the Netherlands, are going to start demanding their own referendums on the European Union. And some have been saying then that this could cause the entire European project to just disintegrate. There may be some accuracy in that, but the Centre for European Reform, which is a London-based think tank, over the last week or so, they put out a report that I think draws some really interesting conclusions when they look at what would the European Union look like without Britain. And ultimately, they write that, I mean, they have a few conclusions. One of the things is that Britain could, in the very long run, give a new push to Eurozone integration. And so that actually without Britain kind of gumming up the works and preventing the Eurozone from drawing closer and just generally slowing things down, things could actually move faster without Britain. And Bloomberg View have a piece on this this think tank report. And we have some quotes from this article in our Trumpet Weekly. And they write that all in all, unless one believes in the magical effect of Brexit on Eurosceptics' electoral performances throughout Europe, the EU's loss from Brexit would be easily manageable. It's likely that the momentous event would bring the remaining EU members closer, ultimately contributing to the creation of a truly borderless market that, as a unit, would be more competitive with other global economic powers. So a big boost to European unity, actually, potentially, if Britain leaves.
Seems like, historically speaking, Richard, this wouldn't be so out of the norm for Britain. It seems like the role that Britain's played in Europe has been somewhat of a divisive role.
Right, and another big area that they point to Britain's divisive role is in defence. They make the point that without Britain in the European Union, Britain is one of the strongest, if not the strongest, military power within the European Union. If that leaves, there'll be a big gap there that there'll be a lot of incentive to fill. And at the same time, Britain has been one of the biggest blocks on Europe drawing closer together where it comes to military and defence. And so without Britain, there might be less opportunity for the less opposition to the establishment of a European defence policy. And so you could see a dramatic increase in Europe's defense relationship and a much stronger push towards a European military as well without Britain.
Yeah, I think that's what's really cool about this article. It really does get into some of the things that we've been discussing and warning about for years. We know from Bible prophecy that Britain will not permanently be in the EU. It's going to either leave or be kicked out. Something's going to happen that's going to rearrange its relationship with the European Union. And we know that prophecy says that Europe will actually turn on Britain at some point here in the near future. Richard, thank you very much for that report. We have to move on here. We are running out of time. Time flies when you're having fun. But 12 years ago, a much younger, much better looking, much more muscular Robert Morley traveled to Thailand for his honeymoon. And ever since then, I've had just a real soft spot in my heart for that nation. It has just been one of the... Thai people must be some of the most welcoming people, I think, in the world, the most friendly people in the world, and their nation really is beautiful. That's why this next story is a little bit sad for me. Jeremiah, Thailand's been having some trouble of late.
Yeah, Andrew spoke earlier about one of the most underreported stories in recent years, and I think this one is a runner-up to that, or a possible contender even for that title. And it is just that Thailand has reverted from a democracy to a military state by sheer force. And despite promises from the ruling junta, it appears unlikely to return to a true democracy anytime soon. In 2006, Thailand was the scene of a spectacular coup. It toppled the democratically elected prime minister. He was corrupt, so he was overthrown by that military coup, and the military wrote a new constitution for the nation. And then in 2011, the sister of that ousted prime minister became the new prime minister in a landslide victory. But that lasted about 3 years until another military coup rose up and forced her to stand down. And at that time, the leader of that second coup, a high-ranking general named Prayuth Chan-o-cha, became the new prime minister. And Chan-o-cha always promised that the military would hand power over in an election back to the people. Over and over and over, he's said that the military would relinquish that, but it does not seem to be happening. We've included a story in the Trumpet Weekly this week. It was originally published in The Diplomat. I'll just read a quote from that. In Washington last week, Thai Prime Minister Chan-o-cha tried to reassure foreign policymakers that Thailand was indeed headed back to democracy next year. 3 years after Chan-o-cha launched a coup, he promised that the generals would hand over power and hold an election. But events in Thailand suggest that Chan-o-cha and his allies actually are digging in for the long haul. And the article goes on from there to discuss this new constitution that he's been writing up and just how extremely undemocratic it is. It goes into effect next year, and it would allow the military to control the selection of the vast majority of senators who would sit in the upper house of parliament. It also gives unelected government bodies and officials far more power than they ever had under the previous constitution. It gives soldiers basically unrestrained police powers. It bans public discussions that are critical of Chan-o-cha or the ruling junta there. And it potentially allows for an unelected prime minister, which could become another avenue for the military to keep on wielding power even after the elections that will supposedly happen next year. So it really does look like if this constitution goes through, then Thailand will be taking yet another significant step away from democracy.
Sorry to hear that. Jeremiah, it's really sad. When we were over there, we could tell the people really loved their king, King Rama the Ninth. This was a king, incidentally, that really gave Herbert W. Armstrong, the founder of this organization that produces this radio program you're listening to and the Trumpet Magazine, he gave Mr. Armstrong a lot of favor, welcomed Mr. Armstrong into Thailand, really helped open up a lot of doors for Mr. Armstrong to meet a lot of world leaders around the world, and they had a very close personal relationship that developed over the years. The king now is very, very old, and it's just sad to see his country beginning to suffer in this way. So thank you for that report, Jeremiah. Next, we're going to news from Canada. Andrew, this is my other favorite country, being that I'm Canadian. News out of Canada, not so good.
Yeah, well, you can say what you will about Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, but the man keeps his word, at least where drugs are concerned. This news story, as they said, just this last April 20th, they had about 25,000 people in Vancouver, had a big celebration for National Weed Day, or I guess the long form of that would be National Marijuana Day. I'm hoping that's an informal thing and not an official Canadian public holiday.
But no, I'm pretty sure it's not official yet,
right.
Yet being the operative word.
But the Canadian Health Minister used the event to make an announcement that they're trying to introduce some new legislation to keep marijuana out of the hands of children, because as of next year, they're wanting to legalize the use of the drug nationwide.
Right, recreationally. I mean, Canada already has
the medical right? Even a lot of the U.S. states do as well. But yeah, recreationally.
It's a bit ironic that the health minister is pushing for a drug that has been shown in pretty much every way to be unhealthy for people.
Right, yeah, even if you're going to do that, you'd thought that maybe they'd find another public minister who'd be better to announce it, because they do have, and we've got an article up on the Trumpet right now by Kayla Taylor that really brings out some of the scientific studies showing the reduced memory functions, the reduced learning functions, the increased depression, the increased anxiety, and some of the other ill health effects that result from marijuana usage.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. I appreciate that. We are nearing the end of Trumpet Hour. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. All these stories are in there. We'll finish this program with a lightning round, our regular lightning round of important news items from our panelists, and that's coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour.
You are listening to Trumpet Hour, the week in review. It's time now for our lightning round. One last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention. Richard, take it away.
China tested a hypersonic missile this week. It was their seventh recorded test, I believe. And this is a pretty big deal. Hypersonic missiles are one of the most important things of new technologies in warfare. America has absolutely nothing that can intercept a hypersonic missile. They're not even going to be testing a system that can intercept it until 2021. If you want to hear more about it, tune into our Trumpet Daily Radio show that aired today. We talk about hypersonic missiles and a few other advanced weapon systems that Russia, China, and others are developing that America can't counter.
Okay, thank you, Richard. Andrew.
Yes, well, during a visit to Germany this week, President Barack Obama announced some seeming good news that we live in the most peaceful era in all human history. He said that may surprise young people who are watching TV or looking at their phones, and it seems like only bad news comes through every day. But considering that there's been decades since the last war between major powers, more people live in democracies. We're healthier, wealthier, and better educated.
Okay, good news. Mr. Noctegal.
It certainly, for that last story, depends on how you classify era. But if that era included the last 5 years, you would know that 500,000 people have died in Syria. And just in the last 48 hours, they've been dying at one person every 25 minutes. You might have thought there was a ceasefire going on that was brokered 2 months ago. Well, there was a ceasefire, but it looks to be in tatters as Russian airplanes and also airplanes from the Syrian regime have been bombing Aleppo, one of the last rebel strongholds there. And they even took out a hospital, killing 27 people today, including 3 doctors. So it is not letting up for Syrians.
Thank you, Brent. Richard.
What happens if your country gets the vast majority of its electricity from one dam, then you incredibly heavily subsidize that electricity, giving it away almost for free, and then you get a drought where you get an absolutely massive electricity crisis? We've spoken about this a couple of times on this program. This is what Venezuela is going through. We talked about how they were getting Fridays off. Now, public workers in Venezuela are not just getting Fridays off to save electricity, but they're getting Wednesdays and Thursdays off as well. Venezuela is really building to a potential crisis point. Shops are running out of goods. They can't cope with the subsidy regime. It's getting to the point that it could even threaten government stability. And it's an excellent example for the rest of us of what could happen if you have a socialist, or what can happen when you have a socialist government.
Thank you, Richard. Jeremiah, over to you.
The United States is not the only country struggling with a pandemic of childhood obesity. There is a 29-year study of Chinese children published this week, and it shows that their rates of childhood obesity are rapidly rising. 30 years ago, you would have been hard-pressed to find one Chinese child in 100 that was obese. The situation now has drastically changed. In 2014, 1 in 6 boys was obese and 1 in 11 girls. And researchers say that this is the price China pays for adopting a Western lifestyle and a Western diet.
Okay, we're exporting more than our culture over there. We're exporting our eating habits. I guess that is part of our culture. Back to Andrew.
Yeah, well, there was also a bit of a spat this week between President Barack Obama and London Mayor Boris Johnson after Mr. Obama published an editorial saying that Britain should stay in the EU. Mr. Johnson pointed out that that was a hypocritical opinion and that the United States would never themselves willingly sign up for a supranational agency that would make laws for them. and pointed out that he thinks Barack Obama may have a bit of an ancestral dislike for the British Empire due to the involvement of some of his own past family members, his father and his grandfather, in the fight against colonialism.
In Kenya.
In Kenya.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Andrew. And Richard, bring it home for us.
Well, we're all enjoying the cheap petrol prices at the moment. But the IMF warned over the last week that the Middle East, nations in the Middle East, will be losing $500 billion compared to what they would have been receiving had oil prices been where they have been historically. That's a huge amount of money, and there's a very real risk that low oil prices could even cause governmental collapse and massive instability in a lot of countries, and that's also partly at the cause of what we're seeing in Venezuela. So low oil prices could lead to instability across the Middle East and North Africa.
Okay, thank you for that, Richard, and thank you, gentlemen. We are coming to the end of our program. I'm Robert Morley, today's host for Trumpet Hour, filling in for Joel Hilliker. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive your daily news, to cut out the clutter, and to find out what's really important. Please send us your thoughts, your questions, by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Follow us on Twitter @thetrumpet_com. Find us on Facebook and Google+. Just search Philadelphia Trumpet. Thanks to today's guests, Richard Palmer, Brent Noctegal, Jeremiah Jacques, and Andrew Miller.
Great to be here.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Also, a big thank you to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondo. I'll leave you with some words from Winston Churchill. He said, quote, courage is what it takes to stand up and speak. Courage is also what it takes to sit down and listen. Churchill certainly had a lot of courage, and I think that's something that we will all need more of in the days ahead. Thank you very much for joining us today on Trumpet Hour. Hope you enjoyed it. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.